Well, before entering into the heart of today's lecture, I just had a couple of comments to make following the discussion yesterday, in which the question of proof of the existence of God and proof of the existence of spiritual reality was raised. I believe you were the one who raised it in the discussion yesterday. And so, again, we have this scheme. That there is the spiritual world and the material world. Now this, as I say, is a difference in kind. It is an essential difference because the principle of existence in the material world is different from the principle of existence in the spiritual world. But there's another way of dividing up reality, which we might say is from the point of view of human experience. And that is the distinction between the visible world and the invisible world. In other words, the observable world and the non-observable world. Well, as we know from science and from what we saw last night in our discussion, in the first place, all of the spiritual world is invisible. We have no direct observation of the spiritual world. But also, as we saw very clearly last night, part of the material world is also unobservable. We can't observe ether, for example, which is the medium in which light, from which light is generated. We can't directly observe electrons or photons either, individual electrons or photons. So another useful division of reality is between visible and invisible reality. So, in other words, invisible reality encompasses all of spiritual reality and part of material reality as well. Now, for purposes of science and philosophy, the division between the visible and the invisible is more useful, more practically useful, than the division between the material and the spiritual. I say more practically useful because the higher levels of material reality, that is the invisible level of material reality, approximates spiritual reality, as we saw last night. So, in our dialogue with materialists, we discover that the skepticism of most materialists is not just about the existence of the spiritual reality, but the existence of an invisible reality. In other words, positivism, which is the philosophical doctrine that underlies modern materialism, positivism, which emerged in the latter part of the 19th century as the dominant philosophy generated by materialistic paradigm of science, in which the expression in psychology is behaviorism, and behaviorism is just positivism in psychology, okay? And it says that the only thing that exists is what we can observe, and we can't observe what goes on inside people's heads, we can only observe their behavior. And since behavior is the only thing we can see, that's the only thing that exists. So a strict behaviorist doesn't even believe in the existence of the self. He only believes that there is a biological machine there that produces some behavior and so on. Positivism in, say, the realm of philosophy is essentially existentialism, which says in so many words that the only thing that exists is what is our subjective feelings and experience of what exists, and so on and so on. So radical materialism is the denial of the existence of invisible reality. In other words, it goes back to this Cartesian notion that I mentioned yesterday, that the material world, the visible world, contains its own explanations. Now remember, when Descartes formulated this doctrine, this was even before Newton had described the law of gravity. And as I mentioned to you yesterday, Newton even wrote in the latter part of his life that he did not really believe in action at a distance, that is, in the existence of this invisible force. But he said, I have to, you know, say that this is the only explanation that I can find for the behavior, the observed behavior of bodies, is that there is this attractive force, but I can't really believe that this force is there, that I can't see, and that is acting on any two bodies. Of course, Newton himself was not the only one who had doubts about this. The continental scientists, even Leibniz, also had doubts about this. So there has always been a skepticism about the objective existence of invisible reality. In other words, everybody's willing to admit that invisible reality exists in our heads, in other words, in our imagination, but that there is an objective invisible reality is something which people have been reluctant to admit. Now, the reason why I'm going into this is because the demonstration that there exists an invisible reality, if we forget the distinction between spiritual and material, just the demonstration that there is an invisible reality is very simple and very easy to do. And that's just, for example, the example of gravity that I took yesterday. Again, I take this object. Nothing we can see prevents this object from moving in any direction. Nothing blocks it from moving in any direction. Nor does anything that we can see constrain it to move in one direction or another. Yet, when I let go of it, it goes down, and again and again and again. So, do we observe the force of gravity? No, we don't observe the force of gravity. We don't see any force pushing and pulling on this thing. What we observe, strictly speaking, is a persistent deviation from randomness. Okay? In other words, behavior is random if all logical possibilities occur with equal relative frequency. In other words, to put it in common sense terms, if the behavior of this thing was really random, then we would expect that sometime it would go this way, sometime it would go this way, sometimes it would go this way, sometimes it would go this way, right? That would be random behavior. Any of the logically possible directions would be accomplished if we repeat this over and over, right? You know. But what we observe is a deviation from randomness. That is, we observe that one direction is privileged, namely the downward direction. And there is no observable reason for that, right? We don't observe any reason why. And notice that if we were suddenly transported into space, then that behavior would not occur, but we wouldn't have any, there would be no observable change. In other words, if suddenly the gravitational field of the force were neutralized by, say, another body could come into the gravitational field that has an equal and opposite attraction to the Earth, that would neutralize the gravitational field of the Earth. So if that happened, just at the moment that I let go of this, then it wouldn't fall. But we would not observe any reason why it didn't happen. So we do not observe the force of gravity. The force of gravity is what physicists, modern-day physicists, hard scientists call non-observable. In fact, all of the four basic forces of physics are non-observable. And this is a term that is now very, very frequently used in science, is the non-observables. So when I use the term invisible reality, I'm using this term essentially in exactly the same way that physicists use the term non-observable reality, non-observable entity. And as Abdu'l-Bahá said, the existence of non-observables is deduced from the behavior of observables. In other words, to put it once again directly, what the example of gravity shows, what the example of the downward movement of objects shows, is that the observable world does not contain the explanation for its own behavior. In other words, we cannot explain observable reality observably. So the explanations are the causes for visible reality all lie in invisible reality. It is invisible reality that produces visible reality. Okay? Now this much is totally incontestable. And this will be admitted by any scientist. This is absolutely incontestable. Of course, they don't usually put it in those terms because there is still this materialistic bias. There is still in the heart of the materialist the hope, the faith, if you will, the blind faith, the irrational faith that somehow there will eventually emerge a materialistic explanation for this that will avoid appeal to non-observables. So this is the blind, irrational, fanatic, fundamentalist faith of the materialistic scientist. Okay? It is irrational. It is unscientific. It is on the hardest logical, skeptical terms you want to put it, totally unacceptable. It represents a total lack of intellectual integrity. Yes. I'm not sure that I understand your question, but I prefer not to interrupt what I'm saying right now, if you don't mind. So we have these objective forces. So far, physics has discovered four of these forces: gravity, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and electromagnetic force. Now, let me just say a word about this, because this is very interesting. These forces are ranged in a hierarchy of strength. And associated with each force is a radius of action. And as you would suspect, the stronger the force, the shorter its radius of action. The weakest of the four forces is gravity. And gravity, as we said yesterday, has an infinite radius of action because gravity is a force of attraction between any two entities in existence. Okay? In other words, this is a universal force, as we read in the Tablet of the Universe, where Abdu'l-Bahá says that in order to have order in the universe, God has ordained this universal attractive force, and so on. At the other end of the spectrum, the strongest force is the strong nuclear force. And the strong nuclear force has an extremely short radius of action, virtually an infinitesimal radius of action. Here's why. Because the strong nuclear force binds protons together in the nucleus of an atom. Now, you know that protons are positively charged particles. And the laws of electromagnetic force are such that positively charged particles repel each other. So protons experience a force which repels them from each other. So if only electromagnetic force exists, then the nucleus of an atom couldn't exist because the protons are right next to each other in the nucleus of an atom. Therefore, there must be a force which is stronger than electromagnetic force and which binds these protons together. And that is the strong nuclear force. However, if you separate the proton just slightly, then the protons go beyond the radius of action of the strong nuclear force. In other words, the radius of action of this strong force is extremely short, virtually infinitesimal. And such that if you separate the protons just a little, then the electromagnetic force of repulsion will dominate the strong nuclear force, and they will fly apart. That's what you do when you split the atom, is you separate the protons to the point that the electromagnetic force of repulsion takes over, and that does the rest of the job. So, in other words, this is the current paradigm of microphysical reality, namely that reality is controlled by four forces. Now, physicists are not dogmatic about this. They're quite open to the fact that there may be any number of other as yet undiscovered forces, but we can say that there are at least four identifiable forces. Which have increasing strength and an increasingly short radius of action. In other words, it's inversely related, the strength of the force and the radius of action. The stronger the force, the shorter its radius of action. The weakest of the forces is gravity, and and gravity has an infinite radius of action. It is a universal force. Now, so according to science, I mean, this is not philosophy. I mean, it is philosophy, but it is not just philosophy. It is the paradigm of modern science that the visible world does not contain its own explanation. That is, we cannot explain observable reality observably, or to put it in terms that exactly that the physicists use, that the essential forces or causes of observable phenomena are non-observable. In other words, the non-observable world is the realm of causes of observable phenomena. The invisible world produces the visible world. The visible world emerges out of the invisible world. And of course, it returns to the invisible world. That is, when these macro entities are dispersed, these particles can be transformed into pure energy by the Einstein equation, E equals mc squared. In other words, there's a conversion, a factor of conversion between matter and pure energy. And of course, we can't observe a pure energy. Pure energy is a non-observable. And therefore, we can say that all of observable reality, as Vladimir Nabokov said in one of his novels, of course, he was had this typical Russian pessimism, but nonetheless, it's very poetically said that reality or life is a band of light between two bands of darkness. And this is material reality. This is material reality, namely that material reality, observable reality, observable reality is like a band of light between two bands of darkness. It emerges from invisible reality and it returns towards visible reality. So, in a certain sense, observable reality is a transition from one state of non-observable reality to another state of non-observable reality. Okay? Now, Vahid was telling us yesterday, was showing us how to reason about analogies such as the ocean. Now, let's use this analogy of the ocean. Let's suppose that we're standing on the edge of the ocean. We're standing on the shore. We're standing on the shore. And let's say that what is above the ocean, what is visible, is observable reality, okay? We could also call observable reality concrete reality. In other words, it's something to which we have access without the intermediary of any thought process. In other words, we have immediate access to observable reality. So that's another way of characterizing visible reality. It is that reality to which we have unmediated access. You don't depend on anybody else to tell you that this table exists. I mean, you know this by your own perception. So let's say then that we're standing on the edge of an ocean, and this is an analogy. In the analogy, observable reality is what lies above the ocean because, as Vahid said yesterday, we can't see in the depths of the ocean. So the ocean and its depth is invisible reality, non-observable reality. Now, occasionally, a fish jumps out of the water into the air and returns to the water. Now, when a fish jumps out of the ocean into the water, what does that describe? What? No, but what does that describe? But what geometrically is that? It's the parabola. It's the parabola again. It is the trajectory of the material world that we talked about, all right? That Abdu'l-Bahá said, everything in the material world is born, reaches a point of culmination, and then declines, right? That's just the name we give to this geometrical shape. Okay? And it's a It's known as a quadratic form, and it's quadratic because of the law of gravity, because the law of gravity is quadratic. Okay? Okay. So let's read this again. Okay? Let's read this again. On page 191, 192. Absolute repose does not exist in nature. All things either make progress or lose ground. Everything moves forward or backward. Nothing is without motion. From his birth, a man progresses physically until he reaches maturity. Then, having arrived at the prime of his life, he begins to decline. The strength and powers of his body decrease, and he gradually arrives at the hour of death. All material things progress to a certain point, then begin to decline. All material things progress to a point, then begin to decline. Well, that's exactly the curve. They progress to a certain point, and then they begin to decline. Okay? So the fish jumps out of the ocean and describes this trajectory of all observable reality, of going to a highest point and then declining and then returning to invisible reality. Now, the whole, with respect to invisible reality, the whole of visible reality is like that fish. In other words, what I'm saying is that what modern science has now shown is that the greater part of material reality is non-observable. Non-observable reality is immensely greater than observable reality. So in other words, the radical materialist is not only denying the existence of God and the soul and all of these spiritual entities, he is actually denying the existence of the greater part of material reality itself. Okay? Because the vastness of the ocean and its depth is non-observable reality. And observable reality is like that fish that occasionally jumps out of the water. So all the galaxies of stars you can see, everything you can observe is like that fish that has jumped out of the ocean and is going back to the ocean. That is the vastness of the created world. So this can be easily demonstrated. This can be irrefutably demonstrated. I have given this lecture in a somewhat more elaborated form to academies of science all over the world, all over Russia, and in Kyiv, and the Academy of Sciences in Kyiv, and the university in Kyiv, and universities in St. Petersburg and Kazan and every place else, in Belgium, at Leuven University. I have never had anybody refute or even challenge any of this because it's obvious to anybody who knows anything about science. Now, so this, I think, is the most fruitful way to engage the dialogue with materialists. That is, none of this they can refute because this is the product of materialistic science. In other words, in a certain sense, in spite of themselves, the scientists have validated this thing. In other words, it is with reluctance that they have appealed to these non-observables to explain observable reality. It is not that they have set out to prove that there are these non-observable forces, because there's a principle of science which is known as Occam's razor, which is a very good principle. It's a logical principle. It says you do not posit the existence of an entity unless that hypothesis is absolutely necessary, unavoidable, to explain what you observe. But as we can see, the hypothesis that a force of gravity exists is unavoidable to explain the behavior of this thing. I mean, there's no other way to explain it but to say that there's an invisible force acting on it, right? There is no other explanation. And so it is with reluctance. It is not gratuitously. It is with reluctance. It is with infinite resistance that materialistic science has grudgingly, gradually accepted the existence of these non-observable realities. And as I said earlier, the materialist in his heart still clings to the hope that somehow there will emerge out of all this a materialistic explanation that will avoid appeal to these non-observable forces. And there are people who've tried to do this. There was a guy at Oxford who tried to rewrite physics without mathematics because he correctly observed that once you accept mathematics, you've already accepted the existence of a non-observable realm because you can't observe mathematical entities. You can't observe numbers and so on. The abstract functions of mathematics are already non-observable. And so he tried to reconstruct physics, say just Newtonian physics, the law of gravity, without the use of mathematics, and he succeeded in proving that it's impossible to do, you know. So this, I think, is the most constructive way to engage the dialogue. Now, when we come to the question which Vahid raised yesterday of proving the existence of spiritual entities, that is, of non-composite entities, this is more difficult. This is more difficult because now we're dealing with a part of non-observable reality. In other words, now we have to prove that within the vastness of non-observable reality, there are entities which are not composite. However, this can be done. And this, in fact, has been done. And this is going to be published. Well, it's already published in the Logic and Logos book, the first version of it. Some of you have seen this book, Logic and Logos, in the chapter From Metaphysics to Logic, a modern version of Avicenna's cosmological proof of the existence of God, this proof is given. However, I have since formalized this proof and in a paper called Causality, Composition, and the Origin of Existence. And so this is going to be published, I just thought some of you might be interested, in a book jointly with my brother John called The Law of Love Enshrined. The Law of Love Enshrined. This will come out with George Ronald in the spring. We are supposed to get the final manuscript to George Ronald by the 1st of October, and I think we will be able to do it. And this will contain a number of essays, both by myself and my brother, and an introduction that is jointly written. And it will begin with a prologue on proving the existence of God. It will contain this more recent version of Avicenna's proof, which proves the existence of non-composite entities, in other words, of spiritual entities. And it will contain the proof of the existence of a fifth force, that is, the force of evolution, which is the action of God in the material world in bringing about the human reality. This is contained in an article called A Scientific Proof of the Existence of God, which is already published in the Journal of Baha'i Studies. 5/4, 1994. Some of you may have seen that. So It's volume 5, number 4, 1994. It was about two issues ago. It's called A Scientific Proof of the Existence of God. So all of these things that I've said so far this morning are contained in this article. And I presume most of you from Russian-speaking countries, you know that this already exists in Russian. In fact, I published it in Russian before I published it in English. In fact, I devised the proof on my first teaching trip to Russia when the first question that the Russians asked was, well, prove to us that God exists. So I proved to them that God exists. And so then I published it. But of course, I didn't do it. I mean, Abdu'l-Bahá did it, because the proof is based on Abdu'l-Bahá's tablet to August Forel. And that's all explained in here as well. What? Right. Научное досательского существования Бога. Okay. So that, I thought, was worth maybe taking a few minutes to do that. Now, one other thing I want to point out from the Tablet of the Universe, just to show you that my assertion that I made the first day of the course, remember I said that what was exceptional in the past will become the norm in the future. Do you remember that statement that I made? Well, here on page 4 of the Tablet of the Universe, Abdu'l-Bahá says this explicitly. So let's just look at this. O thou who wingest thy flight in the spacious realms of the love of God, know thou that the knowledges and disciplines, the arts and sciences, which appeared in previous dispensations, when compared to the divine questions, the eternal verities, and the universal mysteries, which have become veiled, unveiled, manifest and brilliant in their meridian glory in this resplendent revelation, are nothing more than illusions and metaphors, nay, they are hardly better than superstitious fancies. So in other words, he's saying that the best of everything, Plato and Aristotle, Descartes, Leibniz, Newton, all of this, the best of pre-Baha'i culture is nothing but a superstitious fancy compared with the knowledge that is contained in this faith. For the all-embracing universal reality is in the eyes of thy Lord analogous to the all-embracing human reality, which passes in the course of its early development through infancy, childhood, and youth. The growth metaphor again. Even though these various stages may manifest certain of the characteristics and virtues of man, remember, I said that occasionally the child will show forth adult behavior. But this is exceptional. So even though certain of the characteristics of man may be showed, yet when what are these early manifestations in comparison to the perfections of the mind, the truths of the kingdom, and the mysteries of God, with which the reality of man becomes plentifully endowed after reaching maturity, the period of its fullest expression. Okay? So I didn't make this up. Okay? There it is. What was exceptional in the past will become the norm in the future. Okay? I cannot resist also taking 2 minutes to point out another thing, which for obvious reasons was particularly pleasing to me. If you notice on page 4 of the tablet of the universe in the bottom, Abdu'l-Bahá says, know then with regard to the mathematical sciences that it was only in this distinguished age, this great century, that their scope was widened, their unresolved difficulties solved, their rules systematized, and their diversity realized. The discoveries made by earlier philosophers and the views they held were not established upon a firm basis or a sound foundation, for they wished to confine the worlds of God within the smallest compass and narrow limit, and were quite unable to conceive what lay beyond. Well, I can tell you as a professional mathematician that when Abdu'l-Bahá wrote this, this hadn't happened yet. In other words, he was speaking of a spiritual reality which has only become manifest in the last few years. In other words, when he wrote this, he said, in this century, the mathematical sciences have been systematized and so on. Now, every mathematician will tell you that. I mean, they'll say, oh, yeah, well, it's only in this century that we have discovered, we have perfected the axiomatic method, and we've systematized the rules and so on and so on. But it hadn't been done when Abdu'l-Bahá said that it had been done. So it had been done on the spiritual plane when Abdu'l-Bahá said it, but it has only become manifest in recent years. And I would like to point out one other thing. On page 7, and this is for those of you who may feel uncomfortable for whatever reason with some of the methods that I appear to be using, Abdu'l-Bahá says, on page 7, know then that those mathematical questions which have stood the test of scrutiny and about the soundness of which there is no doubt are those that are supported by incontrovertible and logically binding proofs and by the rules of geometry as applied to astronomy. So, as I said yesterday, science is from God just as surely as religion is from God. Logic is the tool, one of the tools, that God has given us to establish clear and incontrovertible conclusions. So, I just thought I would point that out, and for the rest, I will leave you to enjoy, as they say, the tablet of the universe, which can be profitably read more than once. Okay. So let's turn now to the business of the Kitab-i Aqdas. We had gotten to the point where we had seen that the human being has three fundamental capacities: knowledge, love, and will. That these capacities are the primary capacities of the human being, like the three colors, blue, yellow, and red, are the primary colors, and all other colors of the spectrum are generated by appropriate subtle combinations of these three colors, right? In other words, purple or green, I mean, green is red and yellow, as we know, but it can be different shades of green depending on the proportion of yellow and red that you have, and so on and so on. So, in the same way, this is another truth, incidentally, a fundamental truth, which is reproduced at all levels, namely, that you can generate an infinite reality from a finite number of elements. Now, again, I could spend a whole lecture on just this principle alone. This, incidentally, is the fundamental principle of genetics. There are only a finite number of genes, but there's an infinite number, a potentially infinite number, of genotypes. Why? Because there's an infinite number of possible arrangements of these genes. The easiest way to see this is simply with the alphabet. Let's take the English alphabet. How many letters are there in the English alphabet? 26. Now let's ask the following question. How many words can we possibly make with these 26 letters? An infinite number. because there's no bound on the length of the word. Every word is a finite entity, but there's an infinite number of words. Or, if you want to say the vocabulary is limited, there's an infinite number of sentences that you can make. There's an infinite number of expressions that you can make with this finite number of words. In fact, it is sufficient, as you can easily see, just to have two letters. So anything more than one suffices to generate infinity. Any more than one of a finite entity can generate infinity. And this is the same principle of genetics. The genes are like the letters of the alphabet, and the genetic code is like finite sequences of the genes. And since there is then an infinite number of possible genotypes, you see. So, and this is a general rule. I mean, as I say, I don't want to go into this, but this is the point. One can generate an infinite number of attributes from a finite number of essential attributes. And this is exactly what God has done with, what is the case with his own attributes. There's an infinity of attributes of God, but all of these attributes are generated by some combination.